Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Healthcare up in the air and a sudden debate on race this week. The president's healthcare reform timetable took a hit. He keeps on pushing.
We just heard today that, well, we may not be able to get the bill out of the Senate by the end of August or the beginning of August. That's okay. I just want people to keep on working.
Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates Jr. arrested at the door of his own home and claims race was the reason.
It was the fault of a policeman who couldn't stand a black man standing up for his rights right in his face. And that's what I did. And I would do the same thing exactly again.
But the officer in question, Sergeant James Crowley, told WBZ he does not intend to apologize.
A lot of yelling. There was references to my mother, something you wouldn't expect from anybody that should be grateful that you're there.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. What do you make of the fight on healthcare, the Harvard professor versus the policeman, with the president now in the middle? And does Dow 9000 mean the recession's ending? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Helene Cooper, White House correspondent for The New York Times. Her memoir, now out in paperback, is The House at Sugar Beach in Search of a Lost African Childhood. Helene, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Tom. How are you?
Good. Great to have you. And joining us from Washington is Liz Halloran, correspondent for NPR.org. Liz, it's great to have you back as well.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Helene, and Liz.
Let's go straight to healthcare if we can. The president on prime time in Washington in the middle of week and then straight to Cleveland, Ohio yesterday, telling a town hall meeting at Shaker Heights High School to continue talking, pushing on healthcare reform. He responded to news that a reform bill would probably not emerge as early as he hoped.
I want the bill to get out of the committees, and then I want that bill to go to the floor, and then I want that bill to be reconciled between the House and the Senate, and then I want to sign a bill. And I want it done by the end of this year.
Republicans enjoying the president's discomfort. Yesterday, House Republican Whip Eric Cantor telling NBC's Today show here that lawmakers needed to approach health care reform very cautiously.
And I think people still have a lot of questions about what it means for them and their families. What does a government plan mean for them? And, you know, it is just imperative, I think, that we get this right. And I think that's where all of us are right now, is to make sure we don't rush to judgment, that we don't just try and get something passed, because we all know what that can lead to.
Right. And other Republicans saying, make sure we kill this. It will trip up. It will break, said one. The president, Helene Cooper. What does this mean for health care reform and for the presidency itself? Is this Obama's first big misstep or just, you know, more time and space for people to keep on working, as we heard him say there?
I think at this point is a little too soon to tell. It's certainly, this is a huge deal for Obama. He staked a lot. I mean, it's probably overstatement to say his presidency is on the line. It's not. But this really is his first big, huge test. And part of his problem is that there are many Americans, putting aside the what's going on the Hill and in the Senate and in the House, there are many Americans who don't feel that Obama has done a really good job of selling this plan to them. There's so many details that have been left unanswered. There's so many questions that they still have. When President Obama gets up and says, you know, in essence, trust me, you know, we'll fill, we'll, mm-hmm. you know, this is gonna, we're gonna, you're not gonna have have to pay more, you're still going to have choice. A lot of people don't really buy that. And there's a great story by Kevin Sack in the Times today, just talking to ordinary Americans, including some people who don't have coverage, health insurance coverage themselves. And you would think these would be the biggest beneficiaries of health care reform, who still are not at the point that they're convinced.
Liz, we've got conservative thinkers Peggy Noonan today saying, oh, look what just happened here. This Teflon president has misread the public attitude for the first time, and it's going to cost him. What do you say, Liz?
Well, everyone's talking about August and what's going to happen in August, the peril of August, and will the president lose momentum on this issue? And one of the questions that a lot of people are asking today is, was that August 7th deadline that he set, the idea that we could get, that the Congress could get some health care overhaul legislation on the floors by then, actually realistic? He's trying to couch it now is that it was a goal to prevent inertia. But there is a lot at stake, as Helene said, not only to get this is his centerpiece, obviously, of his domestic agenda. And if he fails, even Democratic strategists are saying that he's going to have some difficulty down the line with other issues that he may want to promote it as it's part of his agenda. But everyone is talking about August and what will happen when these congressmen and women go home and talk to their constituents, because, as Helene said, it is not clear what the plan will mean for a lot of people, and in particular, what it will cost.
Jack, I want to get you here, but let's listen to a little more of the president here in Cleveland, Ohio, yesterday. And here he is talking about GOP pushback against the health care reform effort.
We had one Republican strategist who told his party that even though they may want to compromise, it's better politics to go for the kill. Another Republican senator said that defeating health care reform is about breaking me, when it's really the American people who are being broken by rising health care costs and declining coverage. You know, the Republican Party chair, seeking to stall our efforts, recently went so far as to say that health insurance reform was happening too soon. Well, first of all, let me just be clear. If there's not a deadline in Washington, nothing happens.
Jack, the stimulus was job one, and health care reform right behind it. Primary goal for this president. He's missed the August recess deadline here. How big a deal is this? What do you see happening?
Well, because he's missed that deadline, or the Congress, rather, has missed it, as Elizabeth Edwards pointed out yesterday, at the rate of 14,000 people a day losing their health insurance, that will mean by Labor Day nearly 500,000 more Americans will have lost health insurance. The president says his problem is with Republicans. It isn't. It's with his own party. Particularly, it's with the Senate Finance Committee and its chairman, Max Baucus. Who is he? Well, the Washington Post this week, in a story titled "Industry Cash Flowed to Drafters of Reform," talked about the unprecedented wave of money that has broken over Senator Baucus and from insurance companies, and his Camp Baucus that he holds for them, his meets and greets, his on and on and on. He's the man who's deciding the fortunes of the insurance companies right now, and he's deeply in their pocket. The second group that's in his way are the Blue Dogs in the House. Who are the Blue Dogs? What do they want? Well, this week the Center for Public Integrity came out with a report on them titled "Blue Dogs Fill Their Bowls with Cash." And this tells how their funding from all sorts of sources, but healthcare, but insurance companies and health drug companies are big in there, that is just poured into the Blue Dogs, and the Blue Dogs now have every incentive to stall, to wait. A former member of the Blue Dogs, one of their founders, Representative Payne, a Democrat, of course they're all Democrats, of Virginia, said firms are, quote, investing in the Blue Dogs in hopes that they will affect the overall balance of power. Investing in the Blue Dogs. So what we have here, I think, are two. You know, we have a public interest in seeing that everybody is covered. We obviously have a public interest in lowering the cost of health care, and a new idea was introduced at that press conference about that. But we also have a very strong subterranean lobby with deep grips on Senator Baucus and that Finance Committee, and a very deep grip on the Blue Dogs.
The new idea being taxing families with $1 million plus income to help pay for this. Let's get a call right now from Des Moines, Iowa. Mario, you're on the air.
Hello, how are you?
Okay, what do you see, Mario?
Well, I have a comment and a question. My comment is, I have not seen or heard a solid argument, specifically on the part of the Republicans, with a counter-proposal of what they have on the table that's better than the president's proposal. And the second part of that comment is, I hope that the American public is not being duped again. The Republicans themselves are claiming that they need more time, and some Democrats as well. My view on that is that they had two terms to bring to the table a solid proposal, and they didn't.
Mario, we've got it. Liz Halloran, how about it? Do you see a health care lobby pushing back reform, or real questions, real concerns tripping it up, Liz?
There are both, and what's interesting is that today that Senator Baucus, who Jack was just talking about, is back at the White House. The president has him there along with Majority Leader Reid to talk about these things. But it is causing a great consternation within the ranks of the Democratic senators, too. Senator Harkin of Iowa and Senator Rockefeller of West Virginia both have criticized the closed-door sessions that the Finance Committee in the Senate has been holding, and feel that, you know, they've even said that lobbyists have had more access to the committee than they have had. There is certainly some concern about that. But I want to talk just quickly about Mario makes a very good point. John Boehner, the Majority Leader in the House, Minority Leader in the House, spoke with reporters yesterday, and to the question about where is your plan, where is your health plan, he said, we're putting the final touches on our bill, and I'm not sure exactly what he meant by that, but there is the Democrats do think they have a point. They're reviving the party of no, ma'am, that they used earlier this year, and are going to go into August with that.
Helene, you're covering the president all the time. You know, you tried to play it cool yesterday in Cleveland on this, saying that's okay. I just want people to keep on working. How do you think the White House is reading what's just happened this week?
I think they're disappointed, but I think they were sort of prepared. They were prepared for this. About a week or two ago, I started to get the feeling that they were not giving up on the deadline, but pretty sure that this was going to end up spilling over. You know, publicly they'll say they're pushing on, and I think they are. But I think this was definitely, there's no question that this was a difficult week on healthcare, and it's been a difficult few weeks on healthcare for the Obama administration. And that's what I'm sort of really curious to see how he ends up handling this. You're right. You know, he is, you know.
Helene, hold the thought. We'll come back. We'll look at the big picture with you after a short break here. Helene Cooper, Liz Halloran, Jack Beatty. We're looking at a big week in the news. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, healthcare reform battles, record U.S. casualties in Afghanistan, Dow up, jobs down, and the president wading into a race-charged arrest. New York Times White House correspondent Helene Cooper is with us from Washington. Liz Halloran from NPR.org is here, and our own Jack Beatty. Lots of attention this week to the arrest of famed Harvard historian, African-American Henry Louis Gates Jr. That all tumbled out. Here's the professor on CNN Wednesday recounting the incident. This is after he was arrested at his home, after the front door jammed, home from a trip to China. You know, neighbors said maybe there's a break-in. They told the police. The police show up. Here's Professor Gates on what he said happened.
I said, this is my house. I'm a Harvard professor. I live here. He said, can you prove it? I said, just a minute. I turned my back. I walked into the kitchen to get my Harvard ID and my Massachusetts driver's license. He followed me without my permission. I gave him the two IDs, and I demanded to know his name and his badge number.
And when you demanded that, what did he say?
He wouldn't say anything. He was just very upset. He was trying to figure out who I was. He was looking at the ID. He didn't say anything. And I said, why are you not responding to me? Are you not responding to me because you're a white police officer and I'm a black man?
Not just anyone arrested here. A big professor, great historian, and friend of President Barack Obama. At his press conference Wednesday, the president was asked what he thought of the incident.
I don't know, not having been there and not seeing all the facts, what role race played in that. But I think it's fair to say, number one, any of us would be pretty angry. Number two, that the Cambridge police acted stupidly in arresting somebody when there was already proof that they were in their own home.
Okay. And with that word and that comment, it got bigger still. Here's the police officer who arrested Henry Louis Gates, Sergeant James Crowley. speaking to reporters in Massachusetts on Thursday. Here's his reaction to President Obama's remarks.
I support the President of the United States 110%. I think he's way off base, wading into a local issue without knowing all the facts, as he himself stated before he made that comment. So I don't know what to say about that. I guess a friend of mine would support my position, too.
Okay, there's an incident, and then there's a kind of a presidential intervention here. Helene Cooper, how do you interpret President Obama's remarks first at the big press conference on primetime national television? What do you make of what he said?
It was such an interesting remark because I was live blogging the press conference for the Times, and it'd been completely devoted almost 100% to healthcare, in which for most of the time President Obama was basically filibustering. We were hearing talking point after talking point. Mm-hmm. We heard this over and over, you know, the same points over and over again. And it was kind of a snoozer, I have to say, at that point. And then Lynn Sweet of the Chicago Sun-Times asked about the Gates affair. And for the first time in that entire hour, you know, President Obama actually answered a question. And so I have to separate what I say from, you know, what he said versus the relief a reporter feels when your question is finally being answered after you've been hearing, you know, dodges for an entire hour. I was not surprised at what he said. President Obama has a tendency, and he did this in Jerusalem, for instance, when he was in Israel earlier, I think was it earlier this year or last year? The trips are running through, and he said, he was talking about the Hamas rockets from Gaza into Israel, and he said, if, you know, my daughters were being asleep at home and there were rockets coming, I would be upset. And, you know, he has a tendency to put himself in the position of things that are going on and to personalize things. So for him to say, you know, I expected that he would say, I would get angry if somebody came into my house and, you know, asked me whether I lived there. I was surprised that he said stupidly. That took it a step further. But, you know, the White House has not backed down from that at all. And what I thought was actually a little refreshing about it was this was a response that you would have gotten if you were in a bar talking to somebody about, what did you think about this? And the question was phrased as, what did you think about this? Mm. And he sort of answered it that way. Now you have to separate the fact that he answered it versus this is the President of the United States. And, you know, should he be saying that to, you know, about a pending law enforcement case? And I think it's the response was definitely really interesting.
Liz Halloran, Brent Staples writes in the Times today that a lot of Americans may have been taken aback if they thought of Barack Obama as the post-racial president. Brent Staples says, well, no. He understands race, and here's the evidence. You know, he wasn't going to just let this slide. What does it mean, Liz?
Well, I read that same piece this morning, and you know, some conservatives have jumped on this and said, you know, the president is disrespecting police officers. He's jumping into something that he didn't have all the facts arrayed before him yet. But as Mr. Staples writes, and I think what Helene was alluding to is that you got a genuine reaction from someone who has knowledge of racial profiling and you know, experience in racial profiling. And as Helene said, he did not back off yesterday. He said he thought it was a, you know, pretty straightforward commentary. He said that you probably don't need to handcuff a guy, a middle-aged man who uses a cane, who's in his own home. And there's been a lot of talk about is yelling at a police officer a crime? Is it a mistake? Gates wants an apology, and Crawley says that Gates should be grateful that that he was there to investigate a burglary and enacted in a manner that suggests a police officer looking to make sure there's no one else in the house and, you know, could have been misinterpreted. So,
Jack, well, an absolutely fascinating incident here. I mean, first, the way the president handled, but the incident itself, this was a black man, an African-American man. It also happens to be a very esteemed, sort of highly positioned black person in this society, in academia, about as high as you can get, you know, with a sort of class standing of his own. In addition to his race, here comes the policeman, and whoa, what a picture.
What a picture. But as the president said yesterday, softening his position a little, he respects what policemen do, and he called this officer, Sergeant Crawley, an outstanding police officer. And, in fact, the record substantiates that. Sergeant Crawley has, in fact, led racial profiling sensitivity classes. And the act of empathy, you just quoted him in, saying, well, the president was sticking up for a friend. I think that's right. The president was identifying with a friend and perhaps over over-identifying with a friend. On the other hand, the blatant fact of a man being arrested in his own home, a man's home is his castle, after he shows ID, although the sergeant says he didn't show an ID that showed his address, that on its face seems highly questionable. And you know, the background of this, we all know what it is, but mm-hmm. just for the record, a study in 2002 of 80,000 residents by the Justice Department of the United States found that blacks were 11% of drivers, but police stopped but 25% of drivers who were handicapped. Hispanics were 9% of drivers who were stopped, but 19% of those handicapped whites.
Handcuffed. Handcuffed.
Yeah, uh-huh. I couldn't read my own handwriting. that whites were 76% of stopped drivers, but 55% of those handcuffed. I mean, that's clearly a pattern of racial profiling. That's the background of this, and nothing can make that go away.
Let's hear from our listeners. Julia in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where the incident occurred. Julia, you're on the air.
Hi. Hello, Tom.
Hi.
It's my first time calling in.
Good to have you.
And I live in Cambridge now, but I grew up in Flint, Michigan, and I was there recently. As a child, I was there when Martin Luther King was assassinated, and my father put us kids in the car and drove us to Detroit, and I will never forget the smell of the riots, the burning of buildings. It seared itself into my memory. And I feel like a changed person since then. But I was there recently, just about 2 weeks ago, and Flint, home of GM, is a very segregated city. And there's a whole north end that is a complete black ghetto. Even though some inroads and progress has happened there, even in my own family, this father who took us to bear witness to what happened. Now, today, when we sit at the dinner table and talk, he'll say, now, I'm not a racist, but, you know, black people age differently than white people.
Julia, how does it tie in to Professor Gates and Sergeant Crowley and the president, if it does?
I feel that people are very racist still. There are racists in my family, and I think Sergeant Crowley and, like, my father, my brother, they don't even know they're racist. The woman who stands up and says, President Obama doesn't have a birth certificate. That is racism, in my opinion. That is saying, you know, well, being equal is one thing, but whoa, them in charge, that's another thing.
Racism comes in very easily. We know that's there. On the other hand, we've got a specific incident here. Julia, thanks for your call. Let's get another from Jay. Hi, Jay, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I think the point I want to bring up is the fact I think this is more about power, and it's working class versus the Harvard elite. And as one who lives in Newton, Massachusetts, I watch many times where people in the local stores treat clerks kind of like as an automated money taker and things like that. And I saw the professor at a newsstand in Harvard Square a few months back, and I watched how he interacted with the people there. And it was kind of like he was into his own entourage and that. And I feel like that probably was a little bit of what went on that night at his house.
The arrogance of power. But then there are all kinds of power here. Skip Gates certainly has power in his own realm. A policeman has power by definition. Liz, what do you say?
Well, I think that some are describing it as more of a something between two determined, confident men that got a bit out of hand, and that there was no one standing on that porch that could have diffused this. But what this has done, though, I think, is continued this conversation that the caller from Flint, who was from Flint, mm-hmm. referred to as sort of this talking about race and latent racism. They're conversations that really came to the fore when Barack Obama obviously was campaigning and running for president and elected. And we experienced some of that last week when Sonia Sotomayor was sitting as the first Hispanic, and only the third woman nominated to the Supreme Court. There are a lot of the country's changing rapidly. There are a lot of conversations that need to be had and are being pushed to the forefront. And I heard someone describe Professor Gates yesterday as the Rosa Parks of racial profiling. I don't think this is a perfect vehicle, certainly, for talking about the overall ills of profiling, but it does open up this conversation, which is a good thing.
Right from the top at the White House. Now, Kathy in Sunderland, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Kathy.
Hi. I just want to say, first of all, I am a member of, like, the hippie generation, the 60s,
okay,
when we did not view police highly.
Mm-hmm.
However, obviously I've matured, a lot of years have gone by. I have a little bit of a problem with my temper, and I am aware, first of all, obviously police do have a hard job to do. They are human beings, and they put themselves in emotional situations all the time to protect and serve the public. And if a white person loses their temper and behaves badly and speaks back to police, they are treated just the way Mr. Gates was treated. They are subjecting themselves to arrest for disorderly conduct. And nobody feels sorry for them. Their friends don't come to their aid. They say, the damn fool, you lost your temper.
You may be right, Kathy, but do you feel absolutely sure? You weren't there, I wasn't there, but could a white police officer come a little further into the house, a little more heavy-handedly, if it's an African-American than if it's a white citizen?
I can think of a lot of reasons why the police officer did go into the house. If the person had been a burglar, first of all, yeah, I don't think anybody would question the police officer's authority to go into the house when they're checking out a burglary.
Yeah, let us pick it up, Kathy, and thank you for your call. I'll take one more call and then go to it. Augusta, Georgia, Sean, you're on the air.
Hi, this incident happened to me about 5 years ago. I lived in a very, what would be considered, upscale part of the city.
Mm-hmm.
They had a few break-ins. It was December 23rd. I had my bed clothes on. My front door was open, and I was getting something out of my car. And I really think it's an issue of anger. I was highly angry, very upset. And the officer asked me what I was doing in a very authoritative, aggressive manner, and I became angry. And the next thing I knew, I was going to jail. I was in the back of a police car. My pastor got me out 2 hours later, and mysteriously the charges were dropped. But it was anger. I was angry because I felt disrespected in front of my home just because I didn't look like everyone else who lived over there. I was I'm a tax-paying person.
Yeah, Sean, I understand, and I hear you. I absolutely hear it. And who wouldn't be vulnerable to that? On the other hand, Skip Gates is a very kind of high-ranking member of society. Is there a higher standard for him to, you know, have a stiff upper lip and kind of deal with it, be cool? Or you think he was right if he expressed anger to express that anger?
I think one of the person said, if there was a calmer head should have prevailed. I think if there was another officer in my incident, he would have calmed the officer. He may have calmed me. There wouldn't have been an issue. I wouldn't have had to go to jail for charges that were later dropped. Calmer head should have prevailed. There was another officer with Mr. Gates. I think he would have said to the officer, I mean, do you go to jail for yelling at an officer? I think he would have said to the officer, look, Mr. Gates, be quiet. Look, officer, let's go.
Everybody cool down. Let's get out of here. Sean, thank you very much for calling. Helene, what about the political ramifications for Barack Obama of raising this? He has so assiduously avoided getting sort of right in the race bullseye, and here he is with the Skip Gates incident.
Well, I'm not entirely sure I would agree with your earlier comment that he's avoided getting in the race bullseye. We've been having this discussion at the Times over this expectation, I think, because Barack Obama is black, that he is going to be taking on racial issues all the time, which I think in itself might actually be a little bit racist because we.
But that's what I mean. Hasn't he? It seems to me he's avoided taking on very clear racial issues.
But he did it just now. He did it last week at the NAACP. He did it in Philadelphia. He's done it certainly more than President Bush or President Clinton or any other president. So I think he's done it less than perhaps we would expect a black president to take it on. But that in itself is my point. Is like our expectations, you know, are tinged by our own background and what we expect him to take on race more because he's a black guy. You know, race, you know, sort of refers to white people as well.
Sure.
I think for Obama, though, it's when he does talk about race, and that's what sort of surprised me at first. He's very, very comfortable. This is a guy, I think, who's very comfortable in his own skin, and he's very comfortable talking about it. And he talks about it, and he seems to have a lot of confidence in his ability to show that he can bridge both sides and he can But he also tends to be pretty matter of fact about it, I think.
I'm Tom Asper. This is On Point. Perfection, a news icon, goes, and tough news for a rapper this week. White Sox pitcher Mark Burley threw a perfect game yesterday against Tampa Bay in Chicago. Here's announcer Ed Farmer on WSCR with the final out.
Ramirez has it, throws. Burley picks a perfect game. His second no-hitter. He no-hits the Tampa Bay Rays. People going crazy here at U.S. Cellular.
We love it when people are going crazy. Walter Cronkite's funeral yesterday in New York, his son Chip spoke about what his father meant to America, especially during the Vietnam War.
His reporter's instincts for fairness and accuracy seemed to me to help Americans on both sides of the political fence understand each other.
And Beastie Boy Adam Yauch announced he has a cancerous tumor in his throat. The group is canceling its tour. Adam was on our show this time last year. Best of luck to you, Adam.
Now you can shuffle numbers, but facts is facts. So many billionaires, while so many lacks. So before the board decide to react, well, come on, party people, share up your stacks.
We're looking at a big week in the news. Healthcare vote pushed back. Is that good or bad? What do you see in the congressional smackdown to the F-22 fighter in the NRA's Capitol Hill defeat on concealed weapons? And what about the uproar over the arrest of Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates, Jr.? Liz Halloran is here, correspondent for NPR.org in Washington. Helene Cooper covers the White House for the New York Times. She's author of the terrific book, The House on Sugar Beach, In Search of a Lost African Childhood, out now in paperback. Our own Jack Beatty is here as well. Jack, I wanted to just hear your thoughts for a second further on the Gates case and on the politics of this. Helene says, well, you know, look, let's not be too presumptuous about what a president would pay attention to. But here, Barack Obama has, you know, this is the kind of racial issue that you can see from the way it's playing out in the media. It's got maybe more divisive potential to it than a lot of what he's stepped into so far, to my eye anyway. What about the politics of this, Jack?
Well, I think there's a part of the politics that's given this saliency that is right-wing politics, that is Rush Limbaugh politics. I mean, he was all over this. He was on the air, TV last night talking about it. It's being ginned up on right-wing radio, and it's being connected to the Sotomayor decision overthrowing the test in New Haven that would have promoted white firefighters because it was discriminatory in her view. The argument is, there it is. He's just for the minorities. But I think that on the whole, the president has walked this line, a line that goes right through himself, mm-hmm. Between white and black, and tried to say, look, we're the same country, we're the same people. And that, I think, is his best message. And I really don't think this is going to have much fallout because it's not really consistent, I don't think, with the president's whole approach to politics, his whole emphasis on improving life for everybody, not just for groups. I'm sure the right wing will continue to bang away at it, but I don't think it gets much traction. And I think his response came out of something very deep in him. It's in his autobiography where he saw how his stepfather was degraded in Indonesia when the government changed, and suddenly he saw what power could do to somebody. Then he went to Kenya as a grown man and found out how power had reduced his father. His father had been high up, and then just because of the whim of some politician was crushed. You know, Dostoevsky says in his notebooks, humiliation opens the gates of hell. Mr. Gates went into, you know, Professor Gates was plunged into hell in that experience of humiliation. And that happens to lots of people everywhere, all over the world. And the president, I think, was right to say that shouldn't happen in America.
On the other hand, he was on ABC's Nightline last night, asked about this behaved stupidly comment and trying to, you know, bring it back to a kind of common sense perspective.
I'm surprised by the controversy surrounding my statement because I think it was a pretty straightforward commentary that you probably don't need to handcuff a guy, a middle-aged man who uses a cane, who's in his own home.
Let's get a call from Colin in Plainville, Connecticut. Colin, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. What do you think?
I'll tell you, I have a lot of African-American friends. I'm Caucasian. I've seen racism all my life. As far as I'm concerned, the president shouldn't say anything about the police. The police are here to do a job. If they tell you to sit down, if they tell you to show ID, you don't argue with them. You do what they say.
But what if, I mean, we don't know, I don't know, but what if it's done badly? What if it's done with racial prejudice? And we know, Colin, that it has been a plenty in American history, right?
Plenty of times, but come on, Tom, you're kidding me, right? Because, you know, if the police tell you to sit down, you sit down. If somebody is robbing his house, who do you call? Who does everybody call? They call the police. The police are in charge, whether you are from Harvard or I'm from Plainville. It doesn't matter. You listen to what they say. You do what they say. You don't argue. You don't say anything. I just totally disagree with this.
Well, I mean, I agree with you that the police deserve respect and they do a tough job, but we're citizens, they're citizens, and they do have to do it right. I appreciate your call, Colin. Colin, Helene, there is a kind of reaction in Colin's view that has to have a political consequence to it, I guess.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, there's this great Chris Rock video a few years ago where he talked about simple steps for black people when dealing with the police, and the first one is obey the law and don't talk back to an officer. And there is a common sense element of that. I know whenever I'm pulled over in a car or something like that, by pulled over for speeding or whatever, you know, the first thing you think is, you know, sir, and you show respect. And And I think Colin is absolutely right in that case. But you had a caller earlier named Sean, I think, from Augusta, Georgia, who I thought really hit the nail on the head about anger. I think that in part was what Obama was talking about as well when he personalized this. I think if a police officer came in, and I'm a black woman, if a police officer came into my house and challenged me about whether or not I lived there, I would get angry, and I know it's stupid. I completely agree with Colin on that point. You don't challenge a police officer, but I wonder if I wouldn't react the same way that Professor Gates did. And that's where we get to what is going to end up becoming the fundamental point at that point about this whole case is, after you've established, actually, yeah, this is my house. Yeah, I got pissed, but you know, this is the point of then handcuffing you and taking you to jail.
Liz Halloran, you know, that we have so many cop shows in this country now on television. Of all the times you wish there had been a video running, if this is going to become an ongoing saga of interpreting what happened here, oh, how I wish that some kind of record was available.
Absolutely. And when Helene was talking, I was jutting on the word versions. You have two versions here, and, you know, we don't know what they are exactly. We have the police report that is a police report written by the officer, obviously, and we have Professor Gates' report. I've been called a Pollyanna, but I thought it would, with Professor Gates saying he wants to use this, you know, to talk about racial profiling, to write about it and make the issue more public, wouldn't it be terrific if the two of them sat down with a third party and talked about this, and why Professor Gates could talk about getting to the point of his anger. Sergeant Crawley could talk about getting to the point where he felt he needed to arrest Professor Gates. I think that's pie in the sky, but I do think that it would be really fascinating and probably move the conversation forward a lot more than we can do here if there were some discussion about this and why it came to the situation that it did.
Professor Gates says he may do a PBS special on this, so we may yet see that conversation.
That'd
we'll stand
great.
By. Rachel in Boston, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
My comment is that I think that it is critical that we continue to talk about race in this country. It's clearly still a problem. But one of my concerns with the uproar over Obama's comment is that it has taken us away from talking about health care and health reform, which was really the point of his press conference. And I think if you're to look at one issue that disproportionately affects African American, Latino citizens in this country, that is a real issue about race, it is health care and health insurance. And I think it's a shame that this one comment that happened at the end of what I thought was a very informative and important press conference has totally taken over, and now nobody's talking about health reform anymore. We're just talking about this one issue.
Well, there's a lot out there, but I know what you mean, Rachel. And Jack, I mean, this country has ducked health care reform before. It is very difficult. There's a lot of money at play, as you say, and as Helene and Liz point out, You know, a lot of Americans uncertain what they really want here. It doesn't take much of a distraction. And this is a pretty hot one to take the country's eye off that ball, and then off it goes.
Yeah, and I'm sure the president regrets saying what he did just for that reason. You know, I agree with Rachel. I thought it was an outstanding performance where the president, the new idea that he introduced wasn't so much the idea of taxing the affluent as this idea of an independent commission, which is a Republican idea that would look at Medicare every year and challenge the billing practices, make recommendations, and give a up or down vote to Congress on it, rather the way they do with the base closing commission. And if that entity had been working this year, $200 billion could have been saved in health care for Medicare. That's a huge idea. It's a Republican idea. The president was embracing it. The president explained the irrationalities of fee-for-service medicine and how that just puts incentives in the entirely wrong direction, and talked about somehow finding a way to create a healthcare system that relies on, you know, outcomes rather than procedures, that something on the Mayo Clinic lines. And in other words, he was talking fundamental stuff about how to reorganize our health system, healthcare system. And I think that it is a terrible shame that if he had probably said it was an unfortunate incident, no one would be talking about it. But I really think his identification with his friend, as Sergeant Crowley said, came to the fore.
Speaking of videos we have and don't have, here is sound this week from a Taliban video showing captured American soldier, Private First Class Bo Bergdahl of Idaho, missing since late June.
Any message to your people?
Yes, to my fellow Americans who have loved ones over here, who know what it's like to miss them, you have the power to make our government bring them home. Please, please bring us home so that we can be back where we belong and not over here wasting our time and our lives.
Army Private First Class Bo Bergdahl. They're in captivity in a Taliban video that emerged this week. Tough to watch. A very scared young soldier there, Liz Halloran, and not a happy development for the American military that's got plenty of other problems in Afghanistan right now with its big push going on and the highest death toll of the war this month.
Absolutely. It was a heartrending video, and folks in his hometown in Idaho are holding vigils for them and for him, and it is a tough thing to see.
Jack?
We have to hope that he is treated better than we have treated people we have taken prisoner in Afghanistan. We have to hope that he is not essentially given indefinite detention, or as Lindsey Graham said this week about people in Guantanamo, locked away forever. We have to hope that despite the worst efforts of John Yoo and Dick Cheney and others, he is not tortured because we tortured. Isn't it something? When this is why the military was so against these CIA interrogations, because it puts our soldiers at risk of the most degrading and awful treatment imaginable. And we, in effect, have licensed it by our conduct.
The economy in the news this week, as every week as well. But this week, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke giving testimony to Congress and sounding pretty upbeat, more upbeat than usual by any means. Here he's talking about the issue of continuing job loss.
We do expect to see positive job creation near the end of this year, early next year. But it's going to take a while, given the pace of growth, for the unemployment rate to come back down to levels that we would be more comfortable with.
Helene Cooper, you're watching the Obama administration firsthand there in the White House. The Dow above 9,000 this week for the first time since January, up 30%+ since its low around 6,500 in March. That may mean a lot to investors or to people with retirement funds in there, not so much to people who have no job. And Ben Bernanke trying to take both of those into account in one statement there.
Yeah, he definitely was. I mean, the Dow going over 9,000 is a huge deal, but at the same time, we have an unemployment rate that has shot up, and you know, we're not seeing. I don't know that we're seeing the peak yet. Healthcare is huge for the White House right now, but the economy, you know, is possibly even bigger, and they've been consumed consumed by it, and rightly so, and I don't know that we're out of the woods yet.
Liz, do you have a sense in Washington that beyond the Fed or Ben Bernanke's immediate circle, there's a feeling that economic relief is on the way? Are people still hunkered down? I mean, even he is saying it's going to take a while on the employment front.
Well, I think we should watch today. Bernanke is scheduled to be on the Hill with Treasury Secretary Geithner to take questions from House lawmakers to talk about the regulatory reform proposals that they put out in June. And, Financial Services Committee Chairman Barney Frank, who is always a lively questioner, is going to talk about, you know, regulation, hedge fund regulation, and you know, talk about the economy, and it should be an interesting day today to keep an eye on that.
Jack, are you back in the pink with the Dow over 9,000? Are you living large again?
No, I'm not. With this unemployment, you know, some of the statistics on unemployment look like the depression. If you add in part-time workers who people who want to work full-time who have to work part-time, and discouraged workers in some states, you're at 20% unemployment. That's what it was in 1932. We are talking about a severe, severe downturn here, and all the talk about, you know, inflation. We have bigger worries than inflation, and that is to get the economy moving, and above all, to get people working.
But a lot of talk about jobs when they do come back being low-wage jobs, and a lot of talk I'm hearing, Jack, from all over of not the kind of comeback this country is accustomed to, but rather a comeback that forces us to become accustomed to essentially a lower standard of living.
Yes, I've seen that too. Some people call it an L-shaped recovery, not a V, but an L. You go down and then you go across. That would just be terrible. And for equality in America, for upward opportunity. And we can only hope that that somehow doesn't happen. But it looks like something like that is going to happen, and that Americans are going to have to get used to a more straightened circumstance.
And let us just watch how that will keep politics and maybe racial politics as well at some kind of boil.
Indeed.
Liz Hollerin with NPR.org. It's always great to have you. Thank you very much for being here today, Liz.
Good to be with you, Tom.
And Helene Cooper, author of The House on Sugar Beach, now out in paperback, White House correspondent for The New York Times. Helene, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Jack, great to have you here. Have a good weekend.
Thank you, Tom.
And listeners, you can continue the conversation at onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.